It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, campaign donations from wealthy donors are up significantly this fall since courts deregulated overall giving last spring.
First, we're kicking off a week-long series called On the Rocks, a look at Wisconsin's alcohol culture. Each day this week at 5, we'll take a look at a different aspect of alcohol use here in the Badger State.
We're starting the series with a look at how Wisconsin got its booze-soaked reputation and how much the reputation costs us, both economically and in other ways. Julia Sherman is with us. She's the coordinator for the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project. Julia, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for the invitation.
So when you live in Wisconsin and have spent a lot of time here, as I have, growing up here and spending most of my life in the state, the culture surrounding alcohol, it's just sort of the water that we swim in. Can you help us right now to see the state with fresh eyes? How does Wisconsin's alcohol culture look compared with the rest of the country?
Well, I'm not a native Wisconsinite. I came here to go to college. And one of the first things I noticed, and other people who come here tell me they notice, is that alcohol is literally everywhere. It is sold in far more locations in Wisconsin than most other places. Alcohol drinking is almost every appropriate. It's practically at the center of all of our event, even events and locations and sorts of things that wouldn't normally be considered appropriate, like children's events and children's parties. You'll find parents sharing a beer or a glass of wine or at a children's party, which is unheard of in many parts of the state. If you want to get a sense of how other people look at Wisconsin and Wisconsin's alcohol culture, go on YouTube. Go write in Lewis Black, the comedian, and he has a monologue. It's about 8 minutes long on Wisconsin. It's vulgar, I'll warn you, but most of his humor is. But that gives you a pretty good idea about what other people think of Wisconsin. You strip it away and it's not a pretty picture.
Well, how much do we drink in Wisconsin compared to the rest of the nation?
Well, it comes down in two different ways. One, it's the number of our population that drink. How much of our population drinks? About 66% of our population over age 18 drinks at least once every 30 days. That's very high compared to the rest of the nation. In fact, in most states, it's usually closer to 50-50. And our young people drink as well. They're mirroring us. When you even get into senior citizens, over 50% of our senior citizens, people over 65, drink on a regular basis. And that's very high. That's usually the amount that the entire adult population in many states drink. But even more than that, it's not so much that so many of us consume, and I drink alcohol. It's that binge drinking is such a problem in Wisconsin, and it's binge drinking that drives the cost, and it drives the horrific cost in human life and injuries, as well as money.
So who is it that's binge drinking? Is it college students, or is it, you know, a lot of people here in the state?
Actually, it's virtually everyone who drinks. In Wisconsin, 25% of our population over age 18 reports binge drinking. And binge drinkers are 14% more likely to report that they've driven while impaired. So when you're a binge drinker, it raises the risks of all the other negative alcohol-related harms.
Now, I want to back up a little and try to get some context. You've laid out just where Wisconsin is when it comes to drinking habits here, and as it turns out, we drink quite a lot.
We do.
So the question is, where does that come from? Why is Wisconsin doing this? And one suggestion that people make, we put this to our listeners on Facebook, is that it comes from our Germanic roots here in the state, that there is a strong heritage of brewing in Germany, lots of German immigrants here in Wisconsin. Hence, that is why Wisconsin drinks a lot. True or false?
I think it's false, and so does Jack Holzhäder. It's been too many generations. Germany has passed from the living memory of most Wisconsin residents. I only know one person in the state who has family still in Germany, considers herself a German-American. But there is a crumb of truth in there, and that is that the white population has a higher rate of current drinkers in the population than any of the racial subgroups within the United States. In Wisconsin, we're 88% white. In general, the population of the nation is 77% white. So we're probably going to have more current drinkers, but that still doesn't excuse or explain the binge drinking. And if you think it's really all about Europe, you should take the time to go and look at some of the controls they've put on alcohol in Europe and in Germany. It's not the country your great-grandfather may have left 125 years ago. We've all moved on.
So I'm guessing much stricter controls than we have in this state, in Germany, say.
I haven't done a study of German controls. I know that alcohol advertising is very strictly controlled in parts of the EU. In the United Kingdom, alcohol is measured. No free pours in a bar there. All the alcohol is measured, and it is throughout the EU, so that would include Germany. So it's a very different world.
Well, so has Wisconsin always had a troubled relationship with alcohol like we have today, or is this a recent thing?
No. We've not always had this relationship with alcohol. I ask myself the same question because, you know, people say that to me. We've always been that way. We can't change. And I just know that's not true because I'm not riding around on a horse and I can vote. I mean, there have been lots of changes that have occurred here. So I went back and spent a lot of time at the Wisconsin Historical Society, and I learned some fascinating things. In 1839, two brothers, Samuel and Jeremiah Phoenix, went to Wisconsin's territorial legislature and actually created a dry county. They named it after a prominent temperance leader named Walworth. Temperance House is still standing in Walworth County. You can see it there. But that's just an indication. We actually had a thriving temperance association long before we had a commercial brewery. We didn't have one of those until the 1840s, the Owen Brewery in Wisconsin. After statehood, the people of Wisconsin adopted a law that required anyone that opened a tavern to post a $1,000 bond. They had to post a bond that communities could claim against for if there were paupers, which is the term they used at the time. It's politically incorrect now, but these were called paupers' wages, and towns could go back and collect them. Women who claimed their husbands could no longer support the family could go back and claim them, and they actually have the records of a trial that took place in Racine County, where a family collected under this. We had, in the middle of the 19th century, an advisory referendum on prohibition in Wisconsin.
So when does it start?
It passed, but the legislature didn't follow through.
And when does Wisconsin turn that corner and become the state that we see today that does have this more darkly complex relationship with alcohol?
I think it's fairly recent. And the reason I say that is because for years, when you look back through the epidemiological data, which is a tough read, I'll give you, you'll find that for years and years and years, our rates of cirrhosis of the liver were far below the national average. And only in the past 4 or 5 years have they crept up and surpassed the national average, which suggests this recent behavior, it's a factor of a number of things, but it wasn't intentional. People didn't get in a room and say, we are going to create this happy hour, perpetual 24/7 happy hour in Wisconsin. It was the unintended consequences, and people didn't know what the consequences would be.
Is this something unique to Wisconsin, or is this something that you see in the Midwest and Wisconsin just happens to be especially strong in this relationship to alcohol?
Well, we have the highest binge drinking rate in the nation. We can't really say that it's a Midwestern thing because Minnesota, Illinois, Iowa, and Michigan all have much lower binge drinking rates than we are. It indicates that it's a number of factors. I had mentioned at the beginning how we have a lot of places to buy alcohol. Most states have about one alcohol outlet for every 1,400 people. How many outlets per person do you think we have here? How many Wisconsinites are there for every alcohol outlet? 330. That's four times the national average. If folks are driving home, it might be interesting as you drive by very carefully to look and see how many of the places you go past on the bus or walking or driving you can buy alcohol. It's much more than other states. And research shows that when alcohol is very, very available, it does increase demand. So that's clearly one of the factors.
Is it that simple because you can buy it in more places, hence the problem, or is it more complex than that?
Well, it's much more complex than that. Alcohol consumption really comes down to what we call in Wisconsin the four A's: how available it is, how affordable it is, how attractive it is, and how acceptable it is to use it. We've established it's pretty available. It's affordable because we have some of the lowest alcohol taxes in the nation. We have no prohibitions on drink specials, no requirements for minimum pricing. We have no involvement of the state in the sale. We have very relaxed social norms. One of the things that outsiders tend to notice is the first thing you'll be asked when you walk into a lot of Wisconsin homes is, what do you want to drink? And if a young woman says she doesn't want to drink, chances are good she's going to be asked if she's pregnant. And if a man says he doesn't want to drink, he's going to be asked if he has a hangover. There is an expectation that we will all drink, and that's our social norms. And it's those four things that are really driving the alcohol environment. But they drive the alcohol environment throughout the world, and they can be changed.
We're talking right now with Julia Sherman of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project about the cost of alcohol use in Wisconsin and how we got here.
And you can join the conversation. Do you think Wisconsin has a big alcohol problem? And what does alcohol use in the state cost you? How does it affect your life? If you are from out of the state, does the way Wisconsin relate to alcohol seem different from other parts of the country? Call and share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@wpr.org.
We're continuing our conversation now with Julia Sherman of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project.
And you can join the conversation. What do you think of Wisconsin and alcohol? Do we have a drinking problem here? Why or why not? And what is the drinking culture like in your community, in your family, among your friends? Do you think excessive alcohol use is more accepted here than elsewhere? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Julia, looking at the costs of alcohol in Wisconsin, how much does it cost Wisconsin?
The Wisconsin Population Health researchers quantified that at $6.8 billion annually is the cost of excessive alcohol use. Mm-hmm. That's not all alcohol use. Moderate use isn't included. But when it's used inappropriately, it costs us all about $6.8 billion, which comes to close to $1,200 for each of us every single year.
It's quite a number. So what goes into that number?
A number of things. $749 million of it is for health care. Some of it's for the criminal justice system. Some of it is for motor vehicle related issues. A lot of it is for lost productivity, which is, in fact, why alcohol is an economic development issue. It's not a big secret in this country that many Wisconsinites drink during the day, and that results in lost productivity. The other form of lost productivity is the years of potential life lost. Each year, we lose over 44,000 years of potential life lost to alcohol-related deaths. That's a tremendous amount of experience and knowledge that is lost to us, and it has a cost.
We're going to go to our callers now. We've got Ruby on the line with us from Milwaukee. Hi, Ruby.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. What is your take on all this?
So I just want to say it's really interesting because I just moved here a few months ago. I'm originally from Toronto, Ontario, in Canada, mm-hmm. where liquor sales are regulated. And I never really drank that much because, you know, you had to go to the liquor store to buy alcohol and go to a beer store to buy the beer. And there was, like, times where, you know, when the stores closed. But since moving here, I've noticed even myself just feeling like the need to drink to kind of be in conversation or be more social in that aspect. So that was just my comment that I feel like if there was some sort of regulations in terms of where you could buy it or the times, it would have an effect, obviously, on the consumption. And, yeah.
Okay, such an interesting perspective. Ruby coming from Toronto there, thank you for that call. Talking about the sheer availability of alcohol being a big factor for her, but she also touched on something else that is quite interesting, feeling like you have to drink to be part of the conversation, to be part of, I guess what she's saying is a social scene. It comes hand in hand with alcohol.
It does, in many situations. I think we had it highlighted here for us in Madison a few months ago when the Children's Museum wanted to apply for an alcohol license. That's not a venue where you usually would expect to find cocktails or any alcohol beverage served. And thankfully, they withdrew that application. But it really kind of illustrated the fact that it's all alcohol all the time, and it's okay. That normalizes it. And Ruby's right. You will drink more when everyone around you is drinking. It's human nature.
Well, thank you so much for that call, Ruby. And let's go next to Jason. Jason joining us in Hudson. Hi, Jason. You're on the air.
Hey. Now, this is kind of a unique situation. Family, my family is kind of, I want to say isolated, if you will. It's farm community, homeschooled, etc. The kids there have grown up with beer not being a taboo. And yet, you know, as long as they never really seen anybody get hammered, it was always there available. You know, the 8-year-old would say, "Hey dad, could we share a beer?" And the 8-year-old would go get a beer and pour a glass for himself and finish, you know, a glass for his brother. And it was perfectly acceptable. And now here, you know, several years later, you know, they may or may not have a beer after putting up a mile of hay or whatever, but it's not a, you know, the availability was there, but it's like, it's not part of their, they have to drink. I was just wondering how that, you know, if that has been a case with your guests as far as, you know, not all availability. You know what I'm saying? If you get rid of
right.
the taboo.
Yeah, I think I got what you're saying there, Jason. And this is an argument that, you know, we've heard before. If you look at some people usually point to Europe and say in Europe, alcohol is normalized. You have a glass of wine at the family table. It's not taboo. Therefore, it's not a big deal. There's not as many alcohol problems. And Jason's saying, you know, in the old days in the farm families, it used to be kind of normal to have a beer, an 8-year-old with a father, I guess, to split a beer. And now it's more taboo. So maybe that leads to more demand for drinking. What do you make of that argument?
Well, one of the reasons that it's more taboo now is that we've seen a tremendous growth in the amount of research that documents the impact of alcohol on the developing brain. I think one of the reasons we've seen underage drinking in Wisconsin drop is that numerous groups have been getting this information out there, and parents are taking it seriously. They're no longer looking at it as a rite of passage. A child who begins drinking at age 14 or earlier develops a 41% lifetime chance of alcohol dependence. That's a very important number. So what our grandparents or parents may have done, they weren't trying to harm us. They didn't know what those consequences were. We didn't know until the past 10 to 15 years. It really comes down to Wisconsin has always looked to the future. We did what we knew, and now that we know better, we need to do a little better.
Now, we haven't touched yet on another area, which is drunk driving. Now, when we think drunk driving, we may tend to go to someone who's the repeat offender, who's the seasoned alcoholic, goes to the bar, goes over, and is used to trying to get behind the wheel and maybe causing some damage, maybe taking a life. Is that the right picture to have in mind, the repeat offender?
Actually, people that die as a result of a vehicular accident where alcohol is involved tend to be people that have not previously had a violation. It's simply a matter of numbers. We have so many people binge drinking. They're 14% more likely to be driving impaired. So they're just the larger group of people. The eighth offense drunk driver, it's horrifying when you read it in the newspaper. But the simple truth is, the paradox is, the guy that just has one too many at the bar on his way home because he binge drinks once a week or once a month, he's as much a danger as the eight offense, drunk driver. And there's a lot more of that guy.
And we're going to dig more into that problem later on in the week in the series. But I want to ask you before we let you go in our last 30 seconds here, can Wisconsin change its relationship with alcohol?
It can, and it's already begun. We've started to get a handle on underage drinking in this state. Numbers have fallen to the national average, and I see communities across this state doing exciting things that cannot be done on the state level. But we're digging in, and we're doing it one community at a time. And Wisconsin is changing. It's exciting.
Julia, thank you so much for joining us.
I appreciate the invitation. Thank you.
This was Julia Sherman, coordinator for the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project, joining us to talk about how much alcohol use costs Wisconsinites. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at Central Time, we'll get our monthly dose of the coolest science stories out there with Discover Magazine editor Gemma Tarlak.
First, a new report out today from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel shows that big political donations from Wisconsin's wealthiest donors are up significantly since the court struck down limits on overall political donations this past spring.
The total amount of money any individual used to be able to spend in a single campaign season was $10,000. Now it's unlimited. In light of that change, 38 big donors in the state have given over $680,000. That's $300,000 more than they would have been able to do under the old laws.
Those in favor of the deregulation say this makes political donations more transparent since they're giving directly to candidates as opposed to third parties. Critics, though, see this as increasing the potential of political influence of America's wealthy.
Here with us now to talk about these new numbers, we have Patrick Marley. He's the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel State House reporter, author of the new report. Patrick, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, can we tell at this point if this extra money is changing the way this fall campaign is going here in Wisconsin?
I don't know that we can detect that. You know, a lot of money gets spent in campaigns every cycle. They seem to escalate, though I would say we had an aberration with the 2012 recall, which we probably won't hit those numbers again for a long time. This is just, another sign of the ongoing trend of increased money in campaigns.
So let's dig down into exactly how this used to work. What has changed here is what they call the aggregate limit, right? Not how much I donate to one candidate, but how much I donate to all candidates in this election cycle. Do I have that right?
That's correct. So the individual limits are in place. There's a set amount that you can give to any particular candidate. You can give $10,000 to a candidate for governor, but you can only give $500 to a candidate for the state assembly. And they have, for every office, there's a limit. But the state used to say in a year you couldn't give more than $10,000 to all candidates combined. So if you were giving $500 to assembly candidates, you could only give to 20 of them. Then you hit your $10,000 total cap, and you couldn't give any more. A man from Racine named Fred Young Jr. sued over that. Around the same time, there was a federal case that had gone further through the process challenging similar limits to Congress. The U.S. Supreme Court decided in April that such aggregate limits were not constitutional, that they were an inhibition on the right to free speech. And then soon after that, in the state case, the state conceded that that was unconstitutional because of the U.S. Supreme Court decision, and the state limits were struck down.
So now if I had the money and the inclination, I could give to a candidate in every race from governor down to county coroner if I wanted to.
You could give the maximum contribution to every single person who's running for the state legislature, as well as to the governor and all state offices.
So you, in this piece, looked at who was donating. Who are some of the big names going above what would have been the old limit?
So there are 38 people so far this year who have given more than $10,000. Many of them are familiar names. Topping the list was Chris Abley, the Milwaukee County executive and a longtime funder of mostly Democrats. Sometimes he gives a little bit of money to Republicans. But he gave $96,000, more than $96,000 this year. $80,000 of that went to the state Democratic Party. $10,000 of that went to Mary Burke, the Democrat running for governor. Some big givers on the Republican side would be Terry and Mary Kohler. Terry Kohler's long been a funder of Republican candidates and causes. He's the son and grandson of former Wisconsin governors. He and his wife Mary have given $57,000 together this year to Republican candidates.
And now we're looking right now just at Wisconsinites making those donations. Is that right?
Well, we ran a list of every single person who would have given more than that. There were, as it happened, I think it was 36 of the 38 were from Wisconsin. There were two people from Texas who had given. But what we found in this instance was that it was not a lot of out-of-state money that was flowing into Wisconsin over the cap.
And these are donations directly to candidates. So all we hear about outside groups, money going to those, that's not what we're talking about here.
That's right. So there's sort of a separate system in which people can give to independent groups to spend money in campaigns. That money is largely unregulated and unseen. So before these limits were in place, all these people were free to give as much as they wanted to these outside groups, and that continues to this day. So we're not capturing a big piece of the puzzle because it's only in unique circumstances where you find that out. But for instance, Abe Lee, who I mentioned before, he told me when I talked to him on Friday that he had given $250,000 to the Greater Wisconsin Committee, which is a liberal group that runs ads in state and local races, and they had campaigned going against Milwaukee Sheriff David Clark. Abe Lee was a big funder of that, as it turns out.
Now, looking at these big 38s, is their money going mostly to Democrats or Republicans?
It went about 60% to Republicans from what we found. Keep in mind this is a narrow window here. It's only been since May that this has been allowed. So we are seeing spending on both sides, but it went $410,000 to Republicans so far this cycle and $273,000 to Democrats or liberal groups.
And this is all so far. Do you anticipate these 38 racking up more donations or more people joining that list of 38 between now and Election Day?
I think either could happen. I would not be surprised to see any of these people joining the list or others coming onto it. That could very easily happen. You know, the campaigns have about 6 weeks to the election. They will only be increasing their ask and seeking money anywhere they can as they race to November 4th.
One of the arguments people have made in favor of doing away with this cap on overall campaign donations, again, directly to political campaigns, is that there's transparency. You still know who donated the money directly to the campaign, which with political action committees and outside groups, it's harder to know sometimes who donated that. Is that how it's playing out here?
That's exactly what the advocates of this say, is that, you know, we're going to have a lot of money in politics. It's better to have the public know, as I was saying, there are these outside groups where you can give or corporations can give and the public doesn't find out about it except in unusual situations. So the supporters of this say, look, this allows the public to analyze where a candidate is getting their money and whether they think that person supports what they support.
And the campaign finance reform community not buying it?
No, they say this just continues the escalation of money in campaigns, and that for every dollar that goes into on the disclosed side, many more dollars go in on the outside side, and that this will only fuel more money into elections.
And those political action committees, recently another cap, as I understand it, was removed on how much money can go to them.
Yeah, and this could be much more significant, but it only happened on Friday. The group CRG Network, which is Citizens for Responsible Government out of Milwaukee, 10 or more years ago, they were involved in a lot of recalls at the local level during the pension scandal in Milwaukee County. They sued because there's a similar limit on how much candidates can receive from a combination of political action committees. And so they had tried to give money to candidates who had already received the maximum PAC money that they could accept. And so U.S. District Judge Rudolph Randa on Friday agreed with the CRG Network that appeared to be unconstitutional and said that candidates can accept as much political action committee money as they want. They, from any particular PAC, there's a limit, but they can take it. There's no limit to the total amount of PAC money they can get. That could have big implications for elections. I think we'll have to see how that plays out, but that could mean a lot more PAC money in any given candidate's campaign coffers.
The big story at the national level seems to have been fewer and fewer restrictions on how much money can be donated and from whom. Is that the same story we're seeing here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, this story for the individuals that I wrote is, you know, directly a result of the U.S. Supreme Court decision in April. They struck down the aggregate limits for members of Congress, and so then when somebody was challenging the state limits, the federal court had to acknowledge what the U.S. Supreme Court did. So that's, you know, this continues that trend of restrictions on campaign finance being struck down over the years.
Well, Patrick, I'm sure you'll keep watching these numbers. Maybe we'll check in with you again in a month or two. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
That's Patrick Marley. He's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's State House reporter, looking at a new report he wrote today showing political donations are up from Wisconsin's wealthiest donors this campaign after deregulations, as he just mentioned, from the U.S. Supreme Court this past year. Tomorrow, a new issue of Discover Magazine hits newsstands, which means we have one of the magazine's editors here to give us a sneak peek at some of the coolest stories from the world of science this month.
Gemma Tarlak is a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, good to have you back.
Always great to be with you.
So this month you've got a feature looking at how security measures, things like fences on the Mexican-American border, are affecting the animal life there, animals like the pronghorn and jaguars. What are you finding? What's the link?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. It's such a hot topic now with all the concerns about illegal migration across the border, but no one's really talking about the fact that there are more than two dozen threatened or endangered species, including the pronghorn. As you mentioned, there's a pygmy owl, jaguars, other animals, that really they are getting just hemmed in. There is no place for them to go, and it's affecting their genetic diversity because of the fences, because of the highways, because of the increased grazing of cattle, and also just other elements of human development.
So the ecosystem for these animals doesn't obviously recognize the international border. So previous to these fences, they wandered back and forth as part of their natural deal, right?
Right, exactly. And that's what allowed genetic flow, you know, to make sure there was no inbreeding and that there was a healthy population. And, you know, one of the ironies is in the story, our writer goes along with members, a biologist and members of the Border Patrol, and they come to one of these 12-foot high walls that has been erected to keep people from crossing the border illegally. And the biologist says, you know, a person could get over that. An animal couldn't. And it's kind of this really sad irony. And these are pretty, you know, iconic animals of the American Southwest, whether you're talking about the pronghorn, the Sonoran pronghorn, which a lot of people misidentify as an antelope, but it's actually a different species, or, you know, the jaguar. There are all these animals that their populations are being disrupted, and as a result, they're not as healthy. Their numbers are shrinking, and it's really kind of tragic.
Is this primarily a story of genetic diversity and these fences stopping that from happening, or is it also about not available habitat for range and food?
Oh, absolutely. It's about that as well. And, you know, they talk about, we're all aware of that horrible drought we're having now in our western states, including that area. So, you know, they're already trying to survive the drought, trying to survive all these highways and other things, and now they've got drones in the air looking for people crossing the border illegally. You know, the trucks roaring up and down these desert areas, really disrupting them and stressing them out and making it even harder for them to survive. So it's definitely survival in terms of the individual animal finding sufficient food and water, but it's also survival of the population through healthy genetics.
Well, one thing I thought was really interesting was that scientists, the biologists here, are applying lessons from island biology to these, in effect, artificial islands that are being created by highways and borders.
Yeah, it's a theory called connectivity. And what they're looking to do is identify what they call safe corridors, ways that animals can move from one island, you know, from one isolated area to another. And they've gotten a lot of money, actually, from the Department of Homeland Security, which is trying to mitigate the damage being done. So they're getting money, and they're trying to apply it to find ways to identify these safe corridors and protect them to make it easier for the animals to get where they need to be and get the resources they need without compromising the border's integrity. It's a very tricky thing, but they're working on it.
Right, so right now you mentioned things like 12-foot fences. Are there alternatives to things like that that would be more animal-friendly but still have the desired effect immigration-wise, illegal immigration-wise?
Yeah, I know. I think you'll find a lot of different opinions on that. I think, you know, the biologists would certainly argue that there are different ways, whether they're things like animal overpasses and underpasses through the highways, things, by the way, that have been used successfully in Canada, not on the border, but just in busy national parks with a lot of highways. the Canadians have found ways to create, you know, safety corridors, artificial corridors like overpasses and underpasses that allow animals to maintain their territory. So there's a lot of discussion about that, but, you know, there's always the concern that, hey, if an animal can get through, a person can get through, and, you know, a person's going to be motivated to get through. So there's a lot of debate and contention in that area. There are options. We're just not sure if they're going to really work.
Well, moving on to another story of interest to us here in the radio world, evidently how people talk, something about our voices can give a cue as to how tall we are. How does that work?
That is true, and you sound about 5'9 to me, am I right?
Whoa. No, actually, 6'6. 5'9, dead on. Well done.
Wow. That was pretty impressive, Gemma.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I did meet you years ago, but anyway. These two experiments by Washington University psychologists. First, they had two people of the same sex but different heights read identical passages to people who couldn't see them, and people were able to say who was taller and who was shorter just by their voice. And they repeated, they had a different experiment where five people from the same sex read the same thing, and people had to rank them without seeing them by height, so ranking them solely by their voice but determining how tall they were. And they got that, too. They were able to tell, yeah, that guy's shorter than that guy. They think it all has to do with something called subglottal resonance, and that's actually really hard to say, subglottal resonance. Basically, taller people have larger lower airways, and it's in the lower airways that certain sounds are produced. And if you've got a larger lower airway, those sounds are able to reverberate and create a deeper pitch. So, you know, none of us are thinking about that, like, his subglottal resonance told me. But on some, you know, subconscious level, we're very aware of that difference. And that enables us to say, yeah, that guy sounds tall. Ah, she sounds short, you know, whatever. So it's a really interesting find. And they think, you know, it might have actually some applicability in even criminal proceedings. If you have eyewitnesses, why not have ear witnesses?
Wow, that's really interesting. Could have all kinds of implications, I suppose. If you're thinking about dating and you talk to someone over the phone, does this voice make me look short? I don't know. It sounds like it's just the beginning of understanding how, you know, how we perceive height and what that means and how to tell.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know about you, but I do sometimes, you know, talk to someone on the phone and think, wow, that sounds like, you know, a really big guy or, you know, whatever. And I'm picking up subconsciously on that subglottal resonance.
That was the original proposed name for our show, by the way, subglottal resonance. I want to say that again and again.
Once you're able to say it, you just can't stop saying it.
Central Time just barely nudged it up. But maybe we should reconsider it in light of this research.
Yeah, definitely. Well, one more story now before you go. The story about the creator of Guitar Hero, right? The console game all the youth are playing, and older people too, I gather. But he's up to some interesting new stuff.
Yeah, he does a lot of different things. And he describes himself as more like the godfather of Guitar Hero. Apparently, he lit the flame of inspiration and then helped guide some other people to create it. But he's definitely in the founding fathers of Guitar Hero. And he is looking at all the different ways sound has a relation to our health, both in can listening to sound improve our health, and also by listening to the sounds we make, can we diagnose potential health problems?
How would that work?
Well, it's actually really fascinating. There's this thing called Parkinson's Voice Initiative, and he mentions it briefly in the interview. It's actually you are able, the researchers, if you talk into a phone and do phonations, which are basically kind of the vocal sounds, and you make a series of phonations, and researchers record that telephone call, run it through some software, they are able to say whether or not you have Parkinson's, and they're actually able to diagnose earlier than standard tests, which is pretty amazing when you think about it. And it has to do with the level of vocal impairment, something you or I might not pick up on talking to someone, but the algorithms in the software actually enable the researchers to identify specific vocal impairments in the voice just by making phonations, again, the kind of open sounds, that can help diagnose Parkinson's early. And that is just, I mean, think about that. That is fantastic.
And then briefly, there was also mention in that of using musical training to help post-stroke patients learn how to talk again.
Yeah. He talks about another researcher who actually developed a melodic intonation theory, which is a specific set of steps where you teach someone to speak rhythmically with some pitch variations. Someone who has lost the ability to speak, such as after having a stroke, is able to learn to speak again much more quickly than traditional methods by following this kind of music-based method. They're not really sure how it works yet, but I think it's a wonderful illustration of how music can really, you know, be a healing process in our lives.
Well, Gemma, thanks so much, as always, for being with us today.
Always fun. Thank you, guys.
That's Gemma Tarlak. She's Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She joins us each month to discuss some of the most intriguing stories from the world of science.